Well, we're going through this little book on wrath. I think last time we got to about page 28, but I just want to go back to page 22. We're talking about the matter of sin, what it is. And it's no easy task to discover the nature of sin. But depending on what we think of sin is how we'll see forgiveness happening. And on page 22, halfway down, it says, even if God were to issue a fiat, which he does not, that all sins are forgiven, this would not satisfy the conscience. Some people think that God could just forgive sin by issuing a fiat. Do you know what a fiat is? It's a kind of command or announcement that says, okay, all sins are forgiven, that's it. And where people think, oh, great, yeah, good. But God doesn't do that, and God can't do that. That's not how he forgives. That's not how he can forgive. Because you can't just... Sin is of such a serious matter and a deep matter that you can't just say, oh, that's all fixed just like that with a wave of the hand or a magic wand or issuing a command. And why you can't do that is what we're going to be looking at today, and what sin is that requires God's wrath, that requires something, God to do something about the sin and about his wrath. We saw that sin isn't just a disease, something we catch, something that's gone wrong with us. It's something we actually do. It's something we actually do against God. That is deeply defiant and offensive towards him. We're not just the victim of our sin, we are the perpetrators. So what we're going to look at today is Romans chapter 1, and if you've got Bibles, it'd be good to have that open in front of you, because we need to read through. We're going to see that wrath is in the Bible, it's 586 times or something in the Old Testament, and not so many times in the New Testament, but the same sort of proportion. And in the New Testament, the classic description or definition or setting out of the reality of God's wrath is in Romans chapter 1, and we begin from verse 16. Paul says, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith, as it is written, the one who is righteous will live by faith. So what's Paul doing there? Well, he's saying, I'm going to tell you about the gospel, which is the good news that I bring. And it has to do with the power of God to save us. And it has to do, it's something that you can know by faith, and it's something that you receive by faith. And it brings you into righteousness. The righteousness of God is revealed through this gospel. So you'd expect him to start talking about the righteousness of God, which he does. But he talks about it in a particular way. He says in verse 18, for, going on with the explanation of what the gospel is, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of those who by their wickedness suppress the truth. So that's just what we've been seeing, that where there is ungodliness, where people go against God, and where there's wickedness, where they act in an evil way, then God's wrath, which is the reaction of himself and of his love and all that he is against what is ungodly and against what is evil, must come on that. And what are these people doing? They are suppressing the truth. What's the truth? The truth is God, and everything God is and God, everything God does and all of God's creation and the way he's made everything. So that's set out, we see, plainly for everyone to see, but they have to, because they've gone against God, they have to kind of push that away and push it down so that they're not looking at it, so they can't see it, so they don't know what it is, so they don't have to be faced with it all the time. And the way they do that is by doing acts of wickedness. God tells us to be righteous as he's righteous, but to force that out of the way, we'll do the opposite. We'll do wickedness, and we'll keep doing wickedness, and we'll keep saying that that's okay, because that keeps God and all the truth about God away from us, because that's what we've rejected. So that's the situation into which God's wrath comes. There's no excuse for us as sinners. Verse 19, for what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the things he has made, so they're without excuse. They knew God. So in the things that God has made, and we're part of what God's made, we can know the nature of God. We only have to look in the mirror, don't we? Say, or just look at ourselves and say, I am fearfully and wonderfully made, and I'm made in the image of God. That would tell you a lot about God, wouldn't it? I've been made for love, for relationships. That's what works best with human beings, love. So that tells you enormous amounts about God, doesn't it? And the way he structured the universe to be in love. So all of that we're resisting, all of that we're pushing down and suppressing by deciding to go against that and go our own way in our acts of wickedness. So they're without excuse, for though they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him, didn't relate to him as he really is and honour him and say that everything comes from him. Give thanks for that. They say no. Hello. We're not honouring God as God, we're honouring ourselves as if we were God. We're not giving thanks to God for everything that's come from him, because we're saying, well, it's come from us anyway. All lies, but we try and keep it up. That's how we live. I can do it. They became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Well, that's the way it'd have to be if you're not facing up to the way things really are, but living a lie. So nothing that goes on up here then is actually the way it really is. It's all confused, it's all dark, because you've opted for the lie. And so though you might be coming up with brilliant thoughts, they'll all be flawed or wrong, and on a wrong basis, because they've denied the truth of God. And their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal human being or birds or four-footed animals or reptiles. We're still, God's made us to worship him. We're not going to worship God, we're still structured to worship. So we're going to have to worship something, and if it's not going to be God, then it's going to have to be something that God has made, something in the creation, or something that we've made out of what God has made. So he's talking there about making idols and worshipping them, making, bowing down to something that isn't God. And that's what we have to do. If we won't worship God, we're going to end up doing that. There's going to be something in our life that takes the place of God, or a whole range of things takes the place of God, that we give honour to, that we say thank you very much to, that we look to get what we need from God, satisfaction in life. So that's the situation. We've suppressed the truth, we've gone against God, we've worshipped something else instead, and our thinking's gone all crooked. And how does the wrath of God come upon that? Well, Paul tells us in the next verse, verse 24, therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to the degrading of their bodies amongst themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator who's blessed forever. So how does God's wrath come on us? Does it come just down and say, I hate that, and I wipe it all out? Well, Paul's saying, no, that's not how the wrath of God comes on sin. The wrath of God enters into the situation and gives us over to it. Gives us over to what's in our hearts so it can play itself out. So if you're going to set your heart on yourself, then he gives you over to yourself and to the lusts of your heart and what that'll do to your body. And that verse 24, God gave them up. He didn't give up on them. He just gave them over to what was in their heart so it could come out. And verse 26, for this reason God gave them up to degrading passions. Their women exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural, and in the same way also the men giving up natural intercourse with women were consumed with passion for one another. Men committed shameless acts with men and received in their own persons the due penalty for their error. So those verses are about homosexuality or gay and lesbian relationships and how people have moved towards those and away from marriage of a man and a woman. Now, what does marriage of a man and a woman tell us of in the Bible? What's that pointing to? When a man and a woman come together, God said, therefore a man shall leave his parents and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And he's talking about marriage. But Paul later says what that is really telling us about is what? Yes, the relationship of Christ with his people or God with his people. Because many times in the Bible, God is depicted as the husband of his people, and our relationship with God is like the relationship of a husband and wife. Now, that's the relationship with God that we've, as sinners, have rejected, isn't it? So every time we see a real marriage, like a man and a woman, we say, I don't want to look at that. That reminds me of the relationship with God, and I've cut off my relationship with God. So I don't want to look at marriage, and I don't want to say marriage is a good thing, and if there's some other way to go, I'll find it. So I won't get married between man and a woman. I'll go and have same-sex relationships, and that'll keep that picture of my relationship with God right away from me because I don't want to look at it. And God says, okay, I'll give you over to that. That is my wrath. So every time you see a gay lesbian Mardi Gras, you say, ooh, God's given us over to that. His wrath is active in Sydney.
It's a different perspective to our tendency might be to say, okay, well, our society is doing, we've got Mardi Gras and all these things happening, therefore it's just a matter of time before God's wrath comes.
Yes. Those things are the actual evidences of God's wrath. He says, if that's what's in your heart, I'll give you over to it, and you'll have to work that right through. And that'll be my judgment on you. It's the wrath. And so you can see us getting deeper and deeper into the mess, can't you? Into the mire, into our sin. In verse 28, and since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, still haven't turned back, God gave them up to a debased mind and to things that should not be done. We've taken on that debased mind when we adopted the lie instead of the truth, and so all of our thinking became darkened and confused and twisted and not the way it really is. And God says, well, I'll give you over to that, and I'll give you over to all the wickedness that arises from your choice. God gave them up to a debased mind and to things that should not be done. They were filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, covetousness, that's greed, malice, that's when you want to do something horrible to someone, full of envy, when someone else has got something that you want and it consumes you, murder, that's pretty clear, strife, deceit, craftiness, sneakiness, that is. They are gossips, they tell lies about each other, slanderers, they tell lies to people's face and put people down, God haters, that's really what it is, isn't it, being a God hater, insolent, that's pleased with yourself and rude with it, haughty, proud, boastful, thinking you're pretty good and telling everybody about it, inventors of evil, not just content with doing one kind of evil again and again, but finding all new ways of doing evil and being very creative in it, inventive in evil, always finding new ways to evade the taxation man, or to hack into somebody's website or something like that. Inventors of evil, rebellious towards parents. Well, naturally, that's going to be one expression of your rejection of God, because God's our father, isn't he? So you reject God as father, you're going to reject your own father and mother, and there'll be generational breakdown of relationships there, and God gives us over to that. Foolish, faithless, can't be trusted, heartless, don't know how to love anymore, ruthless, without any pity for anyone except yourself. And so that's a terrible, terrible picture, isn't it? And you couldn't really get a worse judgment than that, or a worse expression of God's wrath than God to just give us over to that, so that that which is what was in our heart to start with the moment we rebelled against God, for all of that just to come out in all its horror. And then, for this to happen, verse 32, they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die. So God gives the law and says, you shall not do these things, and this is the way you shall live. And we say, yep, but we're not gonna, because we reckon that this is okay. And you do all those things and I'll tell you that you're okay, and I do all those things and you tell me that I'm okay, and we'll all be okay, and God can go hang. So they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, yet they not only do them but even applaud others who practice them. They have to do that, have to back each other up in evil just to keep it going, in the face of the truth of God that is power pounding through all the creation all the time, and the wrath of God that's giving us over to that. So if God gives us over to that, there's no way we can get ourselves out of it, and that's his wrath. Now that's different from the sort of picture of wrath. Well, if God hates it, so I'm going to squash it or smash it or wipe it out. See what I mean? God's wrath enters into the situation and we're embroiled in it, and we're given over to it, and we can't get ourselves out of it. So there's our sin, and there's God's wrath that gives us over to our sin. And so our sinning is the expression of God giving us over to it, which is his wrath. See how sin and wrath are really intertwined? So we find a little statement here, and you can read that section there, page 28, 29, 30, 31. And where's the statement? Page 36. Another way of saying what we've just voiced is to say that God's wrath is not sin, You can't say that God sins when he has wrath on us. He's actually being righteous. God's wrath is not sin, but sin is God's wrath. Of course, we need to qualify this. What we mean is that that guilt is the wrath of God, in the sense that objectively guilt is punishment, and that objectively guilt is punishment, and that subjectively the sense of guilt is disturbing and brings confusion and anguish to the person. Now, you'll have to think through what that means, but what we can see from what we've read in Romans 1 is that our being caught up in sin is God's wrath on our sin. Just like we can say the Mardi Gras is God's wrath on Sydney. That sin is God's wrath, God's judgment on them. Or us being heartless and foolish, faithless, heartless and ruthless, that sin is God's wrath on us, being given over to that. And if we aren't saved from that, and if we don't repent of that, and it's not forgiven, and it's not confessed and not forgiven, then we're children of wrath. We're in the wrath of God, like the rest of mankind. And so you can read about that in quite some detail in those pages, and we won't read through it now. But I hope that what we've looked at so far is helps you to understand it. For instance, have a look at the statement on page 34. Leon Morris, this quote, speaking on verse 24 and following, has this to say: the verb "gave them over" shows that God is active and not passive in the process. When we were looking at it before, we said sometimes people say God's wrath is just a way of talking about the consequences that automatically follow when you do something wrong, like you touch something hot and you get burnt. But that's not it. It's personal, as we saw. God is active and not passive in the process. This does not mean he's vindictive. He's not up there saying, well, I'll teach them a lesson. That would be untrue both to the facts of the case and the apostles' thought. Throughout this epistle, Paul insists that God's purpose is one of mercy. Elsewhere, the situation is viewed from another angle. People gave themselves up to licentious behaviour and they're responsible human beings. And the same is thing here. We are responsible for all the choices we make there and all the things we do. We can't say God made us do it. But God is active in that process. Here the thought is that God is active in the process. He shuts people up to the consequences of their sin so that they will see their error and look to him for mercy and for a better way. Or even if they end up not doing that, they've come to a just judgment. Notice that Paul does not call on God to punish sinners. Rather, he has the profound thought that their immersion in the sins is itself their punishment. One is punished by the very things by which he sins. And with that is the guilt of sin. And so he goes on to pages 36 and go on to talk about the guilt of sin. And guilt is punishment. Guilt is what you've done wrong and being in a state of having done it. But he talks there about the verbs that are used in Hebrew for sin and guilt and iniquity and wickedness and evil and all of those things. And you can't pin any one of those down to one particular English word. And any of you who've done languages, different languages, you'll find there's never one word that means, or really one word that means exactly another word in the other language. So you've got to try and get the feel of it. and you find that the way the Hebrew language understands sin is very dynamic. It's very there's a list here of all the yes, page 44. If we look again, at the terms near the bottom of the page 44, if we look again at the terms used in the Old Testament for sin, we see they cover the following: wickedness, confusion, iniquity, perversion, guilt, transgression, rebellion, wrongness, trouble, vanity, evil, lying, deceit, trespass, breach of trust, error, negligence, injustice, disobedience. And when we add to these the states of guilt which attend all sin, such as fear, confusion, anger, heaviness, dread, the sense of failure, pollution and coming judgment, we're very near to seeing what is the nature of sin and guilt, because they're all of one piece. And the guilt is part of the sin. One, he looks in detail at Psalm 32 and Psalm 38, but we might just look at some verses from Psalm 32. And this is a psalm written by someone who's come into forgiveness, time when David's come into forgiveness. So it starts by saying, happy are those whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. And to have all of that forgiven and all of that covered would be a wonderful release, wouldn't it? Taken away. Happy are those to whom the Lord imputes no iniquity and in whose spirit there's no deceit. All of that cleared out from your spirit, from your heart. But then he goes back to what it was like before he came into that forgiveness. And he says, while I kept silence, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was dried up as by the heat of summer. That's how sin works its way out. Or have a look at Psalm 38. And this is a psalm about someone under the experience of God's wrath. O Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger or discipline me in your wrath, for your arrows have sunk into me and your hand has come down on me. What you feel when you're under God's wrath is the personal pressure of God, God's hand on you. And look at the effects of it. There's no soundness in my flesh because of your indignation. There's no health in my bones because of my sin, rotten through and through. For my iniquities have gone over my head. They weigh like a burden too heavy for me. So it's like being thrown into a quicksand with weights chained to your ankles. You can't get out of it, and you're drowning in it. My wounds grow foul and fester because of my foolishness. I'm utterly bowed down and prostrate. All day long I go round mourning. My loins are filled with burning. There's no soundness in my flesh. I'm utterly spent and crushed. I groan because of the tumult of my heart. And then he says, O Lord, all my longing is known to you. My sighing is not hidden from you. So God's right in that with him. My heart throbs, my strength fails me. As for the light of my eyes, it's gone from me. I can't see clearly anymore. And all my relationships have fallen apart. So all of that is is sin and guilt and the action of God's wrath. And it's all of the piece, and you can't sort of separate it out. So when we say that on the cross, Jesus Christ bore our sin, what are we saying?
He bore our guilt.
He bore our guilt. He came into all of that. And he lived in it, and he bore it all.